This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Colleges don't admit students, they admit applications. That's what a longtime college application consultant says about the current state of college admission in the U.S.
Pretty much they've always taken applications and not people. I mean, they're just looking at it selfishly, and they're looking at a series of symbols meant to represent the student on the pages. And so therefore, when people are admitted, they shouldn't feel too great, or if they're not admitted, they shouldn't feel too bad.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about how students can make themselves attractive to the college of their choice and when they should start trying. We'll also hear that the number of words a child learns goes a long way towards academic success in their future. And we'll spend an academic minute looking for heroes. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. A whole new crop of ex-eighth graders are about to head over to high school. So does that mean the clock is already ticking on their college application? That's what David Montesano says. Montesano is the founder of College Match, which takes a comprehensive approach on matching students to the right college. He's also the author of Brand You, 4 Steps to the College of Your Dreams. He says that colleges admit applications, not students. So I asked him if it was always that way.
No, actually no, because there were points at which if you went to the right prep school, this is a long, long time ago, you know, like 100 years ago kind of thing, the rep would come to the East Coast boarding school, and if you were interested, you would just register, basically. You would go to one corner and just enroll at that point, pretty much, with that college without even applying kind of thing, because you were going to the right type of feeder school. In that case, I guess, there were other ways of doing it. But yeah, pretty much they've always, for the most part, taken applications and not people. I mean, they're just looking at it selfishly, and they're looking at a series of symbols meant to represent the student on the pages. And when people are admitted, they shouldn't feel too great, or if they're not admitted, they shouldn't feel too bad.
Now, you've talked about a branding process that students should go through before, actually long before the application process. When should that start?
Well, you know, I think it should start freshman year, and that's what the book really gets at, is that freshman year is really about exploration and finding what the passion or intellectual excitement is, as we call it, for the student, and they need to explore those things, and it's not only from in class, but it should be expressed out of class as well through extracurriculars. So doing that freshman year is a great way to, you know, if you're a parent, really explore that, and then sophomore year, you're trying to build that into something that's more focused and, you know, scaled, if you will. So like if you're doing a musical instrument and you're doing well at it, your kid can maybe sophomore year start to explore doing an ensemble or performing at, say, the regional level through a junior symphony or something like that.
If they already have a particular college in mind, is there a way they could start, you know, molding which extracurricular activities to go to that might fit that school?
Well, I wouldn't recommend that. Here's the problem. Most people choose based on cost, location, and prestige, and they usually choose the wrong way. About 30% of kids transfer right now, and only about 50% to 60% finish in 4 years, according to the Department of Education. So people are making the decisions incorrectly, kind of like the way they get married to people. You know, they do it superficially, and they don't use mature standards. And so I'm not trying to get on people for this, but I would just say that they leave a lot of money and quality matches on the table. Instead, they pursue kind of the shiny object or the thing they've heard the most about, you know, the way people are choosing schools. And I think that is not very enlightened. And I think the way that we're trying to help is through getting people to use mature standards and more internal standards, like their personal values, and looking at what are the exact skills and experiences that I need to achieve not admission to this college, but my life goal. And then which are the 6 types of colleges are going to help me with that journey. So I think we need to get everybody to back up a step and say, wait a minute, you know, who am I? Where am I going? What's the best vehicle to get me there? And then what can I do that's authentic in terms of my spark, and then grow that into a fire, and not to worry about appealing to colleges. It will happen naturally if you sort of self-actualize along the way. That's what colleges want to see.
So when you start looking at actual schools, what are the things other than name recognition, which everybody wants to get into the big name school, what should they be looking for?
Yeah, Bob, I'm glad you brought that up. It's total BS to think that everybody knows what the right name is. You know, it's like we only know the name because we saw it on a football game or whatever, you know, or somebody went there. It has nothing to do with us personally. This is what it's like, Bob. It's like saying, you know what, I'm going to find the right mate for you, and here's a list of Maxim's hottest 50 women. Is that going to be right for you? No, no way. And here's the other thing is people aren't looking at real-world outcomes. it's hard to find. Colleges don't want to tell you about their real-world outcomes because a lot of them suck, frankly. So basically what you've got to do is kick the tires and make sure, first of all, you're getting the right vehicle for your journey. If you need an SUV, why are you in a sports car? You know, so that's why I recommend looking at the six types of colleges. You only do this once. You might as well do it right. That's my thought. And don't leave money, merit money potentially, or the right match on the table. And right now people are leaving both of those things on the table. They're just not getting a good deal here in America for their higher education dollars.
Okay, without giving away too many spoilers, what are those different types of colleges?
Sure. Well, one is a liberal arts college. That's the original one, and that's kind of the Hogwarts idea. You know, it's a medieval monastery. Those educate people with writing, critical thinking, public speaking, and really have the best shot at getting people into medical doctor, law, PhD programs than any other type of school. And here's the cool thing. You don't have to go to the most famous ones. They all do the same thing. For example, you can go to Hendricks College and get that kind of mini Ivy League experience in Arkansas that you get from Princeton. And nobody statistically is really getting into Princeton these days, you know. So you might as well go to Hendricks or Grinnell and get that. Then the other type would be the research universities. This is what everybody knows. And these are more focused on the upper tier of research, meaning graduate level. And it's really where people go to focus on PhDs and professional schools. I don't really recommend them necessarily for undergraduates because undergraduates get cheated. They don't get the personal attention from professors. But if you need a job, it's a better place to go. If you're not going to go to graduate school, it's probably better to go to one of those schools because they have better job networks, simply because they have engineering and business. Liberal arts colleges don't have engineering and business typically. They do economics and, you know, physics. In between is hybrids, and people like those alike. You get some personal attention from professors, some smaller class sizes, and you get a name with some recognition with employers. But remember, if you're going to graduate school, liberal arts is the best. If you're going to get a job, probably all the other types are the best, like hybrids, polytechnics, specialty schools, and research universities.
So how do you, other than being a valedictorian, how do you get these schools to come after you and want you?
That's a great, you asked the perfect question. I think it's by figuring out who you are and then developing a plan around that and choosing. It's sort of like attracting the right mate, you know. If you're just looking at it superficially, no one's going to be really interested. But if you do an authentic process earlier, like we're talking about, you know, maybe starting, you know, freshman year in high school, really deeper thinking, then I think people can really, you know, figure that stuff out, and that will attract people automatically. I mean, I think it really is the opposite. By working on yourself, it's just like when you want to attract a mate, you know, you do that by being the best person you can be. And when you really do it authentically, internally, and don't worry about kind of impressing people, then that's the unintended benefit, I guess, is that people are attracted to you.
Students do this, of course, with their parents. Is there anybody else they should seek out from their school or from their life to help in this selection process who might be a little, you know, removed and not as stressed?
Yeah, that's a great point. Anybody who's independent is probably going to be very, very helpful. I think, you know, if you can afford a consultant, that's really, I'll be honest, I work mainly for the 1%, the top 10%. And that's part of my goal is to get this information out to the 80 to 90% of people that really could benefit from it. But most cases, the parents are very helpful because, you know, we apprentice with our parents. So their ideas and their support is necessary for this process. But I agree with you. I think finding somebody independent, and it could be a minister, it could be a guidance counselor at school, it could be any kind of a mentor, basically. I would say that that's pretty essential for kids to be able to help, you know, to help guide them on their authentic college path.
So other than all the things we've talked about already, what's the one thing you can tell somebody who is, it's about that time they're starting to think about college?
I would say don't leave money or choice on the table. Read my book or expand your view as much as possible by reading as many books on college admission. Another great one is Colleges That Change Lives by Lauren Pope. There's many, many books out there. But I would say really become aware and talk to as many adults and mentors as possible to look at all the options that exist for you.
Again, the name of David Montesano's book is Brand You, 4 Steps to the College of Your Dreams. Still to come, the more words your child knows, the better. We'll explain next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Most of the time, we would accept that quality is better than quantity. But when it comes to talking with your young child, quantity has a lot going for it. That's the message of the 30 Million Words Initiative. Dr. Dana Susskind is a professor of surgery and the director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program at the University of Chicago Medicine. She's also the founder and director of the 30 Million Words Initiative, which says that talking to your child is vital to the formation of their brains, and living in poverty can affect how many words a child ultimately hears. I spoke with Dr. Susskind, who said she made this discovery working with hearing-impaired children.
Yeah, so the 30 Million Words Initiative really comes out of my experience as a pediatric cochlear implant surgeon. It was what really allowed me to see that the most powerful thing in this world is basically parent talk. And how it began was probably about 10 years ago, I started our pediatric implant program at the University of Chicago. And an implant, for your listeners that don't know, is an amazing piece of technology that allows a child born deaf the ability to hear, to talk, and most importantly, to meld into this world, both educationally and socially. And so I started implanting these wonderful little babies who had been born deaf, all who looked to have the same potential to learn how to talk and to learn. But very soon after, I started noticing profound differences in how they were doing. So some of the little babies started learning how to talk and ultimately learning how to read and learn on par with their hearing peers, while others, same time out, would barely be able to communicate. And that difference almost always fell along socioeconomic lines. It was a pretty painful difference to watch. And it was that experience that made me ask the question, why, and what could I do? And at the University of Chicago, as with many learning institutions, there are lots of smart people. And I started talking to people and learning, I actually audited a child language development class to try to figure out why. And it was there that I came upon an incredible study, a study done some 30 years ago by researchers Betty Hart and Todd Risley, that basically demonstrated that by the end of the age of 3, children born into poverty will have heard 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers. And just based on the difference in the number of words and, of course, the quality of words, some of those children started on their academic trajectory and had, typical learning. And those who heard less did significantly worse and really started school not ready to learn, had lower IQs and test scores in the third grade. And I came to realize that the differences in how and how much parents talk to their children have profound differences in how kids do academically. So you ask, well, what did that have to do with your patients? Well, I realized that while cochlear implants, the cochlear implant that I provided a child gave sound access. It brought sound to a child's ear and to the brain, something else was needed to make those sounds have meaning. And that important thing was parent talk. And as a result, I started working on a program for children with hearing loss and their families, but very soon realized that what I was seeing in my deaf population really just mirrored what was going on in the typically developing population at large, and really was the root of what we call the achievement gap, and started the 30 Million Words Initiative.
So is this a purely educational gap, or is there actual brain development that occurs with more words?
Oh, that is a great question. In truth, the differences in language exposure, it's not just about differences in building a child's vocabulary. It builds a different brain. Because in the first few years of life, the brain is incredibly active. Unlike most of our organs, I always say our heart and our lungs and our kidneys that come out fully formed, the brain is pretty underdeveloped. And it's dependent on what it encounters on those first few years. And in this case, language has a really important role. It not only builds vocabulary, but it builds the brain. And that's why it's so important that children are exposed to a lot of rich, positive language interaction.
and this language interaction should start at what age should this all all begin with?
Let's put it this way. At the end of pregnancy, your baby can actually hear. Now, you know, it's fine to start talking to your baby while he or she is in the womb. But from day one, right, when the baby comes out, you need to be starting to bathe that baby in rich language and really bonding. I mean, language is really just the lens into the whole parent-child relationship. And that should start on day one, because that's when the brain is beginning to grow.
Does the disparity, is it completely economics?
So it's actually, you know, what's important is when you look at Hart and Risley's study and the myriad of studies that have followed, that at first glance it looks like it's just socioeconomic. But what is at the heart is really parent-child interaction. So if you're a well-off family that doesn't interact or talk to your child in those first 3 years, it's going to affect your baby just as negatively. And on the opposite side, if you are a family who, you know, doesn't have the resources, living in poverty, but have, you know, are providing a rich early language environment, your child's going to do great. I mean, obviously, there's complexities of poverty that go beyond this. But at the very heart of brain development is a warm, rich, nurturing language environment.
What about the socioeconomic status of a community? Once someone begins school, does that help or hurt?
Well, you know, obviously, first of all, I want to emphasize that it's never too late. This is not a message that it's ever too late. It's just that if we're going to make impact, earlier is better. And those first 3 years of life, which have often been sort of separated from what we consider education, should in fact be considered part of the educational continuum. You know, the impacts of community-wide poverty, absolutely. I mean, you know, this message, you know, the message of 30 million words and what everybody is doing isn't just a message of tell people to go talk to their kids. It's also a message to society and policymakers that we need to support families so that they can invest in their children. It's not simply enough to say, hey, go talk to your kid. We need policies that also support families, because if you don't have enough food or, you know, have unstable housing or violence, it's not going to be highest on your priority list. Having enough to eat should be first, right? On the other hand, if this message becomes, you know, really ingrained in the community, you know, part of the groundwater, and communities are supported and individuals are supported as should be, we can go a long way towards educational equity. It doesn't mean that it's going to happen overnight. I mean, I think that we all have to have a long-term view of this. There's no silver bullets. Nothing happens in an election cycle. But if we truly want to make change, we have to have this long-term view, this evidence-based view. We need science also at the heart for helping make social change.
When you discovered this and started going deeper into it and finally coming up with a 30 million words program, what do you do now to help both parents and children?
Yeah. So I think what's really important is my reframing the question. It's not what 30 million words does for families and children. What 30 million words does is allow families to understand their inherent power. Their inherent power to build their children's brains. We don't give anything. What we do is we allow families who probably their entire lives too often think that they are powerless, too often don't know the science because we haven't effectively shared it. And what 30 million words is about sharing that science and sharing their inherent power. So with that, we allow families to understand the science, we translate it, understand the simple strategies that can be done in everyday moments, whether changing a diaper or taking a bus to the grocery store, as an opportunity to build a child's brain, that they are in fact their children's first and most important teacher. It's often a platitude, but it is so true. But really, this is not just about giving every child the opportunity to reach his or her potential, which is the most important thing, but really it's an opportunity for society to reach its potential. And the fact that a community views each of these children as their own children is the most important thing. the message is profoundly understandable, right? It's easily digestible. But at the same time, we know that nothing is that simple, right? We know that at the heart of everything is this warm, nurturing parent-child interaction. But at the same time, we also know that at the heart of a healthy, you know, society is, you know, not eating too much, not smoking and exercise, but yet sometimes that's the hardest thing to affect. So, you know, while, yes, it is that simple, a rich, nurturing, warm language environment is the key to getting a child ready for school, but getting to that point, yeah, it's hard. It's hard work. So I think that's the thing that we have to keep in mind.
Well, finally, what's next? Is there 31 million words in our future?
Well, you know, we here at the lab, at the university, we are now talking about the next steps for scaling up, working with communities. Because remember, we're a research lab. We've been testing these things in controlled, you know, science. But the next is, you know, getting it out broadly into the community. So that's sort of our next steps. I think another thing that we need to be really thinking about that's been weighing on my mind is, you know, the issues of technology. You know, yes, we use technology to help scale these things. But I think that all of us can go to a park and know that technology is pulling everybody's bandwidth, you know, from all socioeconomic groups. People are glued to their iPhones and their iPads, and they're not talking to their children. That's going to have long-term issues unless we address it and nip it in the bud.
Dr. Dana Suskind is the founder and director of the 30 Million Words Initiative and the author of 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. You can learn more at 30millionwords.org. We hear a lot about heroes in the media, but do people really care that much? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Who is your hero? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Bruce Peabody, professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, explains what heroism teaches us about the divide between elite and public opinion.
Heroes seem to be everywhere in American society. We can find them in the 2016 presidential campaign, in blockbuster movies like The Avengers, and in debates about increasing mental health and other services to U.S. veterans. But our recent research shows that journalists and politicians are drawn to hero talk much more than the general public. Presidential references to heroes increased dramatically after the 1970s, when officials singled out allegedly heroic individuals to advance policy goals and bolster declining political trust. Media references to heroes follow a similar arc. And how about we the people? Public opinion polling shows that ordinary citizens aren't eager to designate people as heroes, and generally insist that heroism is only achievable by a few. Our research focus groups confirm the sense that heroism requires high standards of valor, assuming great risk, and standing for a cause larger than oneself. The different ways in which elites and the mass public talk about heroes is important for two major reasons. First, it's another indication of the lingering divide between Americans and some of their leading institutions. Second, the gap in how regular people, journalists, and elected officials use heroes tells us that we may have lost what has historically been an important tool for getting people to contribute to difficult causes, such as war or economic sacrifice. Thanks to news coverage and political rhetoric, we're awash in hero talk, but it's not obvious the public is listening.
That was Bruce Peabody of Fairleigh Dickinson University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOO Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.